Movies are probably the primary pulpit in America. And those movies have stories, and those stories have structures. The guy with the black-rimmed glasses, he's a friend, again, from the internet. His name is Justin Wells. He teaches documentary filmmaking at Biola. He is a professional cameraman for Hollywood movies. Spammers are calling me because I didn't silence my phone. There we go. And he talks about how stories are structured. And even stories in the Bible have structures. And those structures, well, we usually don't notice the structures themselves, but we sort of follow the structures emotionally as we work through the stories. The hero's journey is a very popular story structure, and it's been worked in Hollywood in a lot of different ways. Last week, we looked at the Abraham story, and you can sort of structure it like a U-shape, but that's not, I don't think, really the Abraham story as much. It might be kind of a rags-to-riches story. Even though he didn't start out in rags, he started out wealthy. But the one thing he wanted, he didn't have, which was an heir. And so last week we walked through his story, leaving his father's home, receiving a promise. And along the way there were trials, and there was waiting, and there was testing. But God gave him the first fruits of the promise that God had made. And the Abraham story is a good story. Abraham dies surrounded by his children, and Isaac, his son, carries on the story. And of course, after Isaac comes Jacob, and Jacob will have, or Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau. And of course, Jacob tricks his hairy brother Esau into selling his birthright for a pot of red stew. And, well, Jacob is a trickster. And so, after he dupes his brother, and his brother figures it out, and his brother wants to kill him, he flees, and he goes to his dupster uncle. But on the way, God stops him and gives him the promise that he gave to Abraham. He said, Jacob, I will bless you. Jacob's not a man to look a gift horse. Jacob is a man that looks a gift horse in the mouth, and is unlike Abraham, who sort of goes and follows and is eager to pursue it. Jacob's leery. He says, well, Lord, if you come through, I'll give you 10%. Whereas, in fact, Abraham gave 10% unbidden. But Jacob isn't ready to accept God's gifts. And so Jacob, at one point, quite physically wrestles with God when, in fact, Laban has tricked him, but Jacob has tricked Laban, and Jacob is fleeing, and now he has to face Esau, and he's convinced Esau is going to kill him and kill his children and take his wealth. But of course, the Lord's promise is on Jacob, and it doesn't happen. Jacob will trick and scheme until God puts him in a bind and shows him that, Jacob, I bless you. That's how this works. Now, as we learned with Abraham, God intends to save the world through Abram and his descendants. And, well, sometimes I talk about the day of the Lord. It's the day of calamity, when the doctor has bad news for you, and it's cancer. That's a day of the Lord. When there's a car accident, and the police show up and say a loved one has lost their life, that's the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord comes in big and small sizes. It comes personally, and it comes globally. And in fact, in the world right now, a lot of people are anxious. Will Ukraine explode into a nuclear war? Will the environment collapse? Will America once again have a peaceful election with a resolution that the country can live with? We all have these anxieties because apocalypse comes in different sizes and shapes. And so this morning we're going to talk about Joseph, and the Joseph story is apocalyptic from beginning to end. Jacob comes out of Mesopotamia, this region of great nations. Joseph is going to go as a slave into Egypt, the other great civilization over which they would usually tussle over the middle ground, which was that promised land of Abraham. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. And this is the account. If you remember, this is the account of Abraham. This is the account of God creating the world. The book of Genesis keeps talking like that. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers. Sounds idyllic, doesn't it? Young man of 17, surrounded by his brothers. Isn't this lovely? It's not so lovely. The sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, well, who are they? Oh, those are the servants of Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah are sisters. How was Jacob married to sisters? Oh, Laban. Laban tricked Jacob, just like Jacob tricked Esau and made him marry Leah when he was working for Rachel, and he worked another 7 years for Rachel. And then Laban gave them two servants, and when Leah was the first to have children, Rachel didn't have any. And then Rachel gives her servant to Jacob and says, have children through her, and children come through her. And then Leah's womb pauses, and so Leah says, here, have my servant have children through her. And so you have this supposedly one family that is full of animosity. Cain and Abel, children of Adam and Eve. Cain kills Abel. Rachel and Leah, daughters of Laban. There, they've got animosity, but they don't battle with bloodshed. They're women. They battle for the favor of their husband and with their womb. And so this division goes in the family, and so Joseph is there with his brothers, but they're the brothers of Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah, his brother's father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. I was watching the sheep, and my brothers are clowning around, and animals are taking remnants of the flock. Well, what? Snitches get stitches, right? Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. That isn't going to go well, having favorites. Because he had been born to him in his old age, and he'd been born to him from his favorite wife, and he made him an ornate robe. So all the other sons knew, yeah, Dad loved Rachel more than our moms. And Joseph gets a beautiful robe, and everyone else is just wearing the other brother's hand-me-downs, and everybody knows the score. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, remember the rivalry between Rachel and Leah for Jacob's love? Now the sons are repeating the rivalry for Jacob's love. Remember Cain and Abel? When Cain thought that God loved Abel better and so killed him? See, these echoes are going down the stories in Genesis. They hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. What does Jesus say about hatred? Don't hate. Why? It's like murder. Why? Where do you think it leads? Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had." Oh, not only do they already hate him, he's annoying. "We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." Oh! His brother said to him, remember, he's younger than all of them, "Do you intend to rule over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Now, here's something to think about. Joseph's not lying. He's having these dreams. God is giving him these dreams. And again, if we were to be, imagine ourselves to tell God what to do, we would say, how about for the sake of the family, you sort of don't bless Joseph so much. Let him be a dullard. Let him be a simpleton, so that maybe the brothers will go easy on him. But no, God doubles down. Then he had another dream, and he told his brothers, "Listen," he said, "I had another dream." You can imagine the brothers just seething. "And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." The sun, the moon, and the stars were bowing to me. And they're thinking, they didn't have psychology yet, but I'm sure they think, the ego on this brat? Someone deserves to take this kid down a notch or four. Then he told his father as well as his brothers. And his father rebuked him. "Well, favorite or no favorite, I'm sorry. Sun, that's dad. Moon, that's mom. Stars, those are the brothers." He's now sort of one-upped his parents and said, "My parents will bow down to me." So his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" But again, remember, this isn't Joseph making this up. He had this dream, and the dream will be true. God is setting up this kid right from the start. His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So he's watching. Jacob is smart. He's sly, he's savvy, he's crafty, but now, instead of having an uncle and a brother to deal with, he has wives and adult sons to deal with, and it's a whole new game. Now, his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem, and now Shechem, we haven't read all of the stories, but Shechem was a place of slaughter where sons of their father, well, they had a sister named Dinah, and she went by Shechem, and one of the young men of Shechem liked her. And so he took her, and he raped her. And the brothers were furious. And then the men of Shechem came and said, "Well, he's in love with her, so I'll tell you what, let's bind our families together." And the crafty son said, "Well, you know, we could give it to her, but in our family, circumcision is the way. So the only way you can join us and be part of us and share in our wealth and have our daughters and have our sisters would be if you, all the men, circumcise themselves." And the people of Shechem got together and said, "Jacob is wealthy. His stuff can be ours." So all of the men went under the knife, no anesthesia, flint knives, ancient world, and were circumcised. And of course, I'm not going to get graphic here, but you don't just do that and pop up and run around joyfully. When they're all bloody and wounded, after they did the deed, the sons of Jacob took out their swords and slaughtered all of the men, and probably kept their wives and their daughters and their goods. And Jacob saw this and said, "Do you know, guys, know what you're going to do? Every town around is going to look at us and say, don't trust them." So now, this echo, here are the sons, and they're grazing by Shechem, where these same sons of Jacob had slaughtered an entire town and taken the women and children, quite likely. And Israel said to Joseph, that's Jacob, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to him, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Remember, Joseph is a tattletale. We already learned that. And snitches get stitches. Then he went off to the valley of Hebron, where Joseph arrived at Shechem. A man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they're grazing their flocks?" "They have moved from here," they said, the man said. "I heard them say, let's go to Dothan." So Jacob went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Now again, the storyteller is very crafty here, because the storyteller makes sure Shechem gets in the story, so we're all reminded about the capacity for violence and calculation and evil of Jacob's sons. Now remember, these are the children of the promise. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Cain and Abel, brother kills brother. Rachel and Leah, sisters who are rivals. Now brothers are once again plotting the death of their brother. Here comes that dreamer. You want to know how to make sure the bowing down doesn't happen? Kill the one that the so-called dreams say they're going to bow down to. Come now, let's kill him and throw him in one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. So we've got murder and we've got lying. And they'll see what comes of these dreams. Ha! You want to know how to kill a dream? Kill the dreamer. But then Reuben heard this, and he tried to rescue him from their hands. So one of the older brothers, we can't do this. We can't kill our brother. Now, whatever his motivation, maybe it's just love of his father because they're always competing for their father's love. We can't do this to his favorite son. Let's not take his life. Don't shed any blood. Throw him in this cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him. So let's just beat him up. Just rough him up. Let's just scare him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of the robes. You must have known they relished that. I'm sure they hated that robe. That ornate robe he was wearing, the narrator reemphasizes it, don't forget. And they took him and threw him in the cistern. The cistern was empty, there was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites. It's their cousins. Abraham's first son with what? Sarah's slave, Hagar, his descendants. Ah. Notice the slave wives, all of this sin just eating at the fabric of the family. Their camels were loaded with spice and balm and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill his brother, our brother, and cover him with blood? You know, just murder out of spite? Why don't we sell him? Then we get money." "Great, Judah. The only thing better than murder is profit. sell him into slavery. Come, let us sell to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood. Yep. He's our brother. Let's sell him. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers put Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in blood. And they took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether or not it's your son's robe. We'll play dumb." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe." Jacob fills in the rest of the story. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph was surely torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. Jacob the trickster, who lied and cheated and fooled everyone, now is fooled by his own sons. Oh, sin just is bitter and calculating and patient. And it does these things. All of his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. That must have galled them even further. "No," he said, "I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Now we're just at chapter 37, and the story is going to go and go and go, and for the most part, finish up the book of Genesis. And this story is so famous, they've made movies out of it. It's an amazing story. Because here's the thing, God blesses people through Joseph. Again, we see the dreams and we think, all this will be at the other people's expense, but God somehow, everywhere that Joseph goes, God blesses the people around him. But this blessing is funny. There's always a giving, and then there's also a taking. You'll notice this with these blessings around Joseph. So Potiphar, who buys Joseph, is blessed, and Potiphar puts him in charge of everything. But then Mrs. Potiphar looks at him and says, "Boy, that young man is fine. He's smart. He's well-spoken. He looks good. He's a slave." All of the men take their turns at the female slaves. Why can't I take my turn at our male slave, Joseph? But Joseph is loyal to Potiphar and says, "This isn't right." And she grabs his cloak and he runs away. Now what's she going to do? Holds up the cloak and says, "He came to rape me." Which way was that rape going, Mrs. Potiphar? You were the master. He was the slave. And so Potiphar hears this and, boy, you just can't get good help. Into the dungeon he goes. In the dungeon, he meets Pharaoh's cupbearer and Pharaoh's baker. And it's like, wow, every time someone does Joseph dirty, it goes down and down, but God seems to put him in exactly the right place to turn it around. So what does Joseph have in the dungeon? Guess what? A dream. And he has a dream, and he says to the cupbearer and the baker, "The baker, it's not going to be so good for you. The cupbearer, you're going to be restored. And when you're restored, remember me." And he doesn't. So the baker is taken out of prison and executed. And the cupbearer comes out of prison and sits at Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph is forgotten. But then Pharaoh has a dream. And there's a dream of seven stalks, fat stalks, seven fat stalks, seven withered stalks. And the withered stalks eat the fat stalks. And seven fat cows come out of the Nile, and seven scrawny cows. And the scrawny cows eat the fat cows. And Pharaoh's like, what's this dream about? And he calls his wise men, and nobody gives him a satisfactory answer. And the cupbearer's like, oh yeah, there's this guy. We had dreams, and he interpreted them. Go ask him. Joseph comes out, says, seven fat years, seven lean years, you'd better build barns, because a famine is coming. Now, the famine, the book of Genesis says, is over the whole world. Now, if you remember in the book of Genesis earlier, the flood was over the whole world. Now, the famine is over the whole world, and Jacob, still wounded from his son's loss, and Joseph's brothers, they're starving. So Jacob says, you worthless sons, go to Egypt and buy food, or we're going to starve. So the sons go to Egypt, and, well, Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. And Joseph questions them carefully and says, are these all your brothers? No, one was lost. Oh, really? And the other is our father's favorite, our brother's brother, and he's at home. And Joseph says, well, I'll give you some food now, but you got to promise to come back, and you got to bring Benjamin, or no more food for you. So he takes food back. You know the story. Come back with Benjamin. Jacob won't have it. They're going to kill him. My final son. And you can just imagine the psychological pain going through the brothers. They've got guilt because they sold him into Egypt, and they're holding this lie. And so they're trying to protect Benjamin. And then Judah, the one who said, there's no money in murder, let's sell him. Judah's also had a transformation by his daughter-in-law. His daughter-in-law, who showed him what an unrighteous man he was, and Judah repented. So now, whereas it was Judah who sent Joseph into slavery, it's Judah who steps up and says to Jacob, if Benjamin doesn't come back, you can kill me and my sons. I guarantee he will come back. So Judah, who sent Joseph into slavery, is the same Judah then who steps up and is changed. Joseph reveals himself to his brothers in kindness, and the family is saved, and the world is saved. Abram's promise is bearing fruit. The whole world is blessed through the seed of Abram. Joseph, this brat who's kept getting sold into slavery, has risen to become the number two man in the greatest empire in the region. Just like Noah saved the world from the flood God sent, Joseph saves the world from the famine God sent. But the brothers are sons of Jacob. And just like when God comes to Jacob and says, I will bless you, when Joseph blesses his brothers, the brothers are like, I don't know. And then Jacob dies, and the brothers are panicked, because maybe Joseph was only good to us because Papa was alive. Now that Papa's dead, do you know what we did to him? Oh, he's going to get us. He's got all this power. He can have us murdered. He can have us tortured. He can sell our children into slavery. There's no end to the evil he can do to us. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us? Oh, you mean like you held against him? And pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him. So they sent word to Joseph. They're too scared to go themselves. And they're going to make up another lie. Your father left us these instructions before he died. Really? This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Joseph knows it's a lie. They're liars. They're murderers. They're thieves. That's who his brothers are. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. He thought, my brothers won't change. Just like my father, who can't trust in God's love for him, my brothers can't trust in my love for them. His brothers came and threw themselves down before him. What were those dreams? There was one sheath, and all the other sheaths bowed before him. There it is. The dream came true. And the brothers, with all of their schemings, set up the dream they tried to avoid, and they fulfilled it themselves. We are your slaves, those who had sent Joseph into slavery. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? And that's a really strange thing to say, because what Joseph believes is that the dreams he had, the intergenerational trauma passed down all the way from Cain and Abel into Rachel and Leah, into Laban, into all of humanity that has gone before, God is somehow working through this enormous, sinful, painful mess of slavery and murder and lying. You intended to harm me, and so they did. But God intended it for good to accomplish what he is now being done. God sent those dreams to Joseph, and we're like, Lord, don't give him the dreams. God looks way ahead and says, no, my promise to Abraham means the world will be blessed through his children. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, saving of the many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he assured them and spoke kindly to them. What is the structure of Joseph's story? Boy, ups and downs and ups and downs. And just when you think, I hope these things don't happen, and then they happen. What is the structure of your story? Maybe you're young and looking forward and thinking, I want things to go like this. Amen. I want it for you too. Maybe you're old and looking back and saying, ups and downs and trials and successes and failures. And I probably learned more through my failures than my successes. Now there's different story structures. Abram's story is wealth and risk and faithlessness to faith. Trial and partial reward. Jacob is a shrewd manipulator whose sin goes down through his children. They bear it. God promised to bless him, but he couldn't trust, and neither could his sons. But God blesses anyway. Through all these stories, God blesses through adversity. People wrong each other horribly. People have wronged you in your life, I'm sure. Have they murdered? Have they lied? Have they sold into slavery? People wrong each other. Jacob wronged Esau. Laban wronged Jacob and set up Jacob's misery. Jacob was a bad father. Brothers wronged Joseph. Others did too. Joseph saw how God works through the story. Satan wronged Job. Job was eventually restored in his lifetime, even though his complaints, he was credited by God as righteous. Jesus was wrong. Did he do anything to deserve the betrayal he suffered at the hands of his Israelite brothers? Did Caesar exalt him to the place of second in command in the empire, like Pharaoh did to Joseph? Was he less righteous than Abraham, Jacob, Judah, or Joseph? Was he wealthy with wives and children? No. Without the resurrection, the story of Jesus makes no sense. Without the resurrection, the story of Jesus breaks the story structure of the way God can bless through adversity. With the resurrection, the story structure can redeem our story structures, even if the wrongs done to us are not redeemed in our lifetimes. Abraham receives a partial fulfillment. Jacob receives a partial fulfillment. Joseph saves the world, but it's a partial salvation. The enduring wrongs without revenge pattern of Joseph and his brothers persists. Do we have faith to live it out? What will you do with your lean years? Because the truth is, when you're having fat years, you can't even hear a sermon like this. Because it's like, everything's good. There's not a lot of earnestness in my prayers. I don't need God that much. But boy, when those lean years come, then suddenly we're down on our knees and we're saying, Lord, it's them seven scrawny cows, they're coming for me. And then what do? Do you hang in there? Do you believe that what Joseph said, through all the ups and downs, could possibly be true? Do you believe that God can redeem even after the grave? Was even Job's redemption or Joseph's redemption adequate? Can you believe that this world means it for evil, but God means it for good? Can you believe in an even larger story on a larger canvas than the old covenant patriarchs had to work with? Can you bless this world as it isn't necessarily blessing you? Will you let this transformation happen so that you are ready to reign in the world to come? Let's pray. Lord, help us in the lean years. Help us to trust when everything seems to be going in a bad direction. Help us to believe that you will not waste our sorrows, but that you will do good even when others mean to harm. Help us to hold out hope and faith that you are God and your kingdom will come and your will be done. Hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen. Would you stand? Thank you. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you his peace. Amen.
Yeah, I think you could pop.